Open with me to Galatians chapter 6. I'm going to be reading verses 1 to 5. First five verses of Galatians chapter 6. And it reads, "Brethren, even if anyone is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. Each one looking to yourself so that you too will not be tempted. Bear one another's burdens and thereby fulfill the law of Christ. For if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But each one must examine his own work, and then he will have reason for boasting in regard to himself alone and not in regard to another. For each one will bear his own load." The letter to the Galatians is Paul's most strident of his biblical correspondence. He wrote the letter to the churches in the Galatian region in Asia Minor. This was a group of churches that he had founded either in a second or third missionary journey to dispel increasing and insidious ideas taking hold among the believers that they had to keep the law in order to be saved. They had to be circumcised in order to be saved. The Galatians were in danger of rejecting the gospel that Paul had preached unto them, which was the gospel of the true grace of God. And you may ask yourself, how does that have any bearing on us today? We don't believe we have to keep the law, but it is essential. We talk about the Reformation, for example. We talk about the fact that that was the core of the Reformation. The fact that salvation is by grace through faith alone. Right? It is not, as the prevalent church of the time would have us believe, grace, faith, and works. And so that is the core of the gospel. And that is what Paul was addressing in this late letter. The thoughts of the letter primarily can be encapsulated in verses 8 and 9 of chapter 4, which reads, "However, at that time, when you did not know God, you were slaves to those which by nature are no gods. But now that you have come to know God, or rather be known by God, how is it that you turn back again to the weak and worthless elemental things to which you desire to be enslaved all over again?" And it is as though Paul is saying, you have been released from this yoke. Why are you trying to be enslaved again? Right? If you talk to a slave, say in 19th century America in the South, he is given his liberty by his master. And yet, if he were to say, I want to become a slave again, I want to be abused, I want to be under the yoke of slavery, we would think that person insane. And it's the same thing spiritually. If we have been released from that yoke, then why in the world we want to be under it again? There were many agitators of the Judaizing party who had an inordinate and confused concept of what the law is and what the law is to do in the life of a believer. The law is not intended to save. The law is intended to demonstrate to us that we cannot keep the law. Therefore, we need something else. And that something else is Christ. They were sowing seeds of discord among the Galatian churches. And many of them, like it happened in the Corinthian churches, were becoming Paul's personal enemies. They were trying to discredit him as a person in order to discredit his teaching. And it is often said that before you can discredit a teaching, the most effective way of doing that is by discrediting the person, the primary individual who is doing that teaching. If you do that, if you denigrate, insult, and destroy the person's reputation, well, then the teaching will suffer by necessity because people will not have trust in the person themselves. Therefore, they will not have trust in what they're teaching. And that's why it's so important when Paul talks about pastors, for example, how they're to be above reproach. And it is because of that very fact that if they are not, then that is going to destroy their teaching. But as Paul wrote to the Roman church, it is by faith and faith alone that we are saved. Circumcision has nothing to do with salvation. And he used Abraham as the example of that very fact. Because he said, Abraham was not circumcised when God, in Genesis 15 declared him righteous. Therefore, he was not circumcised till years later. That could not have been the basis of his justification. It was simply a sign of the justification that he had by faith. So the letter opens with a short greeting. One's immediately struck by the fact that this letter has almost no greeting. In most of Paul's letters, you see where he's greeting the pastors, the deacons, and he's talking about them with a lot of love and so on and so forth. In this particular letter, there's just a couple of verses talking about, in general, you know, there isn't any specific greetings. And it is because of the seriousness of the letter. And you can imagine that Paul probably wrote the letter rather incensed at what was going on in Galatia, realizing that the work that he had done in those churches was in danger of crumbling and becoming of no effect. In the letter, we see none of that. Paul gives a general greeting, and he doesn't mention any of these individuals. And then he confesses his astonishment at the fact that maybe no more than 5 or 10 years after Paul has established these churches, they are already turning away from the gospel that he preached to them. And so he, first of all, defends his apostolate, the fact that the gospel that he had preached to them was, in fact, the true gospel. And you remember in chapter 1, those famous verses 8 and 9, where he says that even if he or an angel from heaven were to come to them and preach a different gospel than the one that he had already preached, they are to be accursed. And so by implication, these people who are trying to destroy the gospel that it is by grace through faith were themselves also accursed. The key verse in this first section of the letter is found in chapter 2, verse 21. There, Paul declares that if the law could save, then Christ is dead in vain. And we can extrapolate from that to all sort of things. We see today, we may not have Judaizers like they did in the first century, but we still have individuals that say that people can't be saved because they're sincere in their works. I was listening to something yesterday, for example, about Roman Catholic position about Islam, and saying that Islam or Muslims can be saved if they are sincerely doing the good in their religion, right? And the first thing that comes to mind about that is, first of all, is anti-biblical, right? And then number two, if that is the case, then why did Christ have to come and die? What was the point of Christ coming, being incarnate, spending 30 years in a body of flesh, being tempted with all the tribulations that attend humanity, and then dying a terribly painful death on the cross, if indeed it is simply by sincerity, by seeking to do good, that we can be saved? And Paul would have none of that. In chapters 3 and 4, he goes on to defend the gospel further and draws a distinction between the law, which is the covenant of Sinai, represented by Hagar, and the covenant of promise, which was the covenant represented by Sarah, the covenant that was made with Abraham before the law. Paul would say the law was not designed to save us. It wasn't even given until 400 years after Abraham. Abraham was declared righteous. The law was given 400 years later. Therefore, you can see from that example alone, and of course, a tremendous example for the Jews, because Abraham was considered the father of the Jewish nation, right? And if Abraham was justified 400 years before the law, then it is obvious that the law was not what justified him. And then finally, in chapters 5 and 6, Paul lays out the practical effects of the gospel. And one interesting thing about this letter is that the section of practical injunctions is pretty short. Doesn't begin till about the middle of chapter 5 and then goes on to the first part of chapter 6, which is, again, not something that is common with Paul. Because with Paul, a lot of times you would see, and we'll talk a little more about this later, the fact that the first half of the letter, more or less, maybe the first third, would be doctrinal, and then the last half or so would be practical. But in this letter, there's a lot of doctrine. And it is because it is an attack against the idea of law saving. And so we arrive at chapter 6, where Paul begins this chapter by saying, if anyone is overcome in a fault, those who are spiritual must restore such a one. In this verse, Paul tells his reader that this individual is caught in a fault, and those spiritual must restore him. And this comes on the heels of the last verse of chapter 5, where Paul says that they are not to divide, they're not to devour, they're not to diminish one another. And so, following that train of thought, Paul goes on to say, even in the most extreme of circumstances, that is, an individual's caught in sin, what is the spiritual individual to do? Is he to look upon them and wag their finger and say, you know, you shouldn't have done that, right? That kind of thing. No, on the contrary, we are to restore them. And it's interesting because the word that Paul uses here for caught is translated variously as caught or discover or surprised by some translations. And so the idea is that the individual is discovered in the very act of committing the sin. But also, you know, some commentators say that it isn't just that the person is caught in the sin. It may be that they were surprised by that sin. You know, they stumbled into it, as it were. They put themselves in a situation that was not a good situation. And because of that, eventually they fell into that sin. And so it could be either one, right? The individual sin comes to light. And of course, we have seen that a number of times with preachers, unfortunately, who have been caught in a sin that they have been committing for a number of years. Obviously, that's not a sin that is surprising them, but they are surprised in that sin. And so Paul is referring to that problem, to the fact that some individuals within the Galatians church, in this particular context, were going back into the law. Right, and some of them may have been sort of like not innocent in a sense. Right, they didn't know any better, and they were being taught by people who perhaps were individuals that they admired or that they respected. Maybe their pastors, right, are teaching these things, and so they just go along with it. And so they have to be restored in that case. And it's interesting how Paul uses the word restore in this context. He uses the Greek word that is the term used to refer to a setting of a broken limb, right? And how do you set a broken limb? You do it very carefully, right? You don't do it in a way that is going to cause more damage, more harm than good. And so that is the way that people who are spiritual are to restore the individuals who fall into a sin. But who are the ones that are spiritual? Right? It's hard for us sometimes to consider ourselves spiritual because we don't want to sound haughty. We don't want to sound like we're arrogant and think of ourselves, you know, I'm spiritual. Right? This other person, that other person, they're not spiritual, but I'm spiritual. Right? And we don't like to toot our own horn, as it were. But the idea here is simply those that are led, who are led by the Spirit. And so if you are led by the Spirit, then you are a spiritual individual. In addition, there are those who, as the letter of Hebrews tells us in chapter 5, verse 14, are the ones who for whom solid food is. In other words, they are the mature ones who, because of practice, have their senses trained to discern good and evil. Right, in the context of the Hebrew letter, good teaching from bad teaching, which was obviously an essential point here in Galatia because that was the problem. They were being taught the wrong thing. And so it was important for those that were spiritual to understand what was good teaching, what was bad teaching, act accordingly and help those who were falling prey to this evil teaching to come out of that sinful behavior. So there is such a thing as a mature Christian, and that seems to be a rather obvious point, right? And something that sometimes I think we ignore. And maturity doesn't just mean I've been a Christian for a long time. It also means an individual who is dedicated to the things of God, who has a willingness to commit him or herself to the things of God unsparingly, and for whom God and his ways and his will is number one in life, bar none. There is God's will, God's way, and then there's an infinite chasm between that and everything else. Of course, we have our physical life, we have our spouses, we have our children, we have our brethren, right? And those things are important. But again, those things are a distant second to the fact that we are committed to God and His will first and foremost. That's so important because a lot of times when somebody that we respect, for example, or that we've known for a long time, somebody that we are friends with, falls away from the faith, decides to stop walking in the way of Christ, a lot of times that causes very grievous harms to us. And there are some people who, because they hold that person in such high esteem and that person is so important to them, they end up themselves falling away. And so it's important for us to realize that we all have feet of clay. Right? No matter how mature we may be, no matter how much we may know the scripture, we all have feet of clay. And so it is the Lord that we have to hold up as our perfect example and not each other. And this leads us to our next point, which is bearing one another's burdens. There are a few Christians, if you were to ask any Christian in this church, would you help your brother in need? They would, to a man, to a woman, say yes. Nobody would say, no, you know, I have other things going on, or whatever the case may be, right? That goes without saying. And especially in a church like this, where I have witnessed, and I'm sure that you have too, firsthand, the fact that people are eager to help one another. When there's a problem, financial situation, somebody needs a ride, somebody needs some work at their home, for example. If we have the capability, the know-how, the resources to help, we are quick to say yes. But that is important, no doubt about it. But that's not what Paul is discussing here primarily. All right, what Paul is thinking about here in verse 2 flows from verse 1. And so the battles, the burdens that Paul is talking about are not primarily physical, but they are spiritual. Right? It is the person who is caught in the sin, who has fallen in the sin, that is the individual whose burdens need to be borne. The term that Paul uses here for the word bear is to help carry another person's load, not to take the other person's load from them, but to help them with it. It is the idea of this individual has a load. They are not able on their own to carry that load. They cannot carry that load of sin or that load of that weakness, that problem that has made them stumble. And so we come alongside and we help them carry that load. I think that there's three things particularly that this passage brings out that are important to talk about in this context. And the first one is that we have a terrible time confiding in one another. James tells us in James 5:16, confess your sins one to another and pray for one another so that you may be healed. The effective prayer of a righteous man can accomplish much. We don't mind talking about all kinds of things, about sports, about life in general, about the weather. We even talk about theology, right? In this church, we talk about theology a lot. And that's a good thing. I'm not going to discourage it. On the contrary, I want people to continue to talk about those subjects, about theology specifically. But when it comes to talking about the deep things that are going on in our lives and our hearts, then unfortunately, we are way too much like the average American, the average Westerner. That's where we sort of like stomp on the brakes, right? And so we have a terrible time confiding in one another. And so it is important for us to understand that in order for us to bear that load of sin, that load that the other individual has, we have to know what's going on with that individual. And the only way to know that, we can't read minds. Right? We can pray to the Lord so that He can help us to bear those loads. But if we are not confiding in one another and confessing to one another, then it's impossible for us to be able to do that. There's a second issue that I find problematic, and that is that we find it difficult to build long-lasting, deep relationships with other believers. Some of us have done that, and that is all to the good, And if that's one of you, if you are one of those individuals, then by all means, continue to do that and help others to build some of those relationships, because that is a big problem that we have. We have difficulty building those deep, long-lasting relationships, right? And even if we have a fairly deep relationship with somebody, that person moves away, and what happens? Goes away, right? We lose contact with one another, and those things go away rather quickly. And so it is important for us to build those relationships, because it is people whom we have confidence in that we are going to be able to talk about those deep things in our heart. Right? If we have shallow relationships with everybody, who are we going to entrust those things to? Nobody. And so it is essential for us to build those relationships. Now, granted, some of us are more gregarious than others. My wife, for example, is a very gregarious person. I mean, she never met a stranger, like the saying goes, right? In my case, I'm the complete opposite. And so I have to force myself to talk to people. You may not think so, but that's the truth. And so so for me, it's a little more difficult to build those relationships. For her, perhaps it's a little easier. But we can't use our personalities as excuses, right? We have to rise above that and say, this is something that God wants us to do. Therefore, we're going to do it. And the third thing that, in my view, is a problem in this area is that many within the body, although we're more than willing to help one another, we're often reluctant to do so spiritually, right? Because we find it hard to, number one, understand what's the problem, right? And then number two, how can I help that problem? You know, I don't know if I'm equipped to help that individual with that particular issue, right? And so we have a tendency to have a problem understanding not only the sinful behavior, correcting the sinful behavior, but then making sure that we are helping that individual along the way. And so it's important for us to recognize that we have the capability. If we are a believer, we have the capability to help others. We may not all be as mature as other individuals, as I mentioned. You know, we're all at a different level in that path of maturity, but we still have the capability of helping others if we have those deep relationships. Those relationships where the individual is going to understand us. We are going to understand them. We know what makes them tick, so to speak. Right? And because of that, the person has confidence that we can help them. And sometimes, just like Job's friends, the first 7 days after they came to him, all you need to do is just sit with the individual, hold their hand. Right? That may be the only thing that you can do, that may be the thing that the individual needs that will bring about that restoration. There's a tremendous synergy that's gained when we understand our relationship with one another, the fact that we are all in this together, right? And that we need to ensure that we are doing those things that will strengthen each other, that will help each other to grow in the faith, and not just to superficially deal with one another. And it is not just the church's task either, right? Or the church's leadership. It is each one of us doing that work, because the pastors and the deacons and some other more mature individuals can do a lot of that work, but they can't do it all, right? In a church like this, and especially as we continue to grow, more people are coming in, right? More people from different backgrounds as well. And so, again, that synergy can be brought to bear with individuals who may be from the same background. They have the same experiences. And so that helps as well bring about that synergy. In 1 Peter 5, verses 8 and 9, Peter said, "Be of sober spirit, be of, on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. But resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world," right? And so if we understand the reality that we're all in this together, then we'll have a more sympathy for one another. It's often heard that a believer a lot of times go through difficulties, and they may not understand why they're going through those difficulties at that moment in time. Take Joseph, for example, as a biblical example. an individual who went through such difficult times. For 13 years, he was in jail, in prison, for nothing he had done wrong. He hadn't done anything wrong, and yet he was cast in prison for 13 years. And over the course of those 13 years, you can imagine he must have been wondering why his brothers had done that. Why didn't someone help him? Why was God far from him? Why was he suffering for something that he had not done? On the contrary, when Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him, what did he do? What was his reaction? He ran away. Right? He could not sin against God that way. And yet, his reward, seeming reward, is he's cast into prison. And yet, later on, when he's lifted up and becomes the second under Pharaoh, what happens? His brothers come to him with their tails between their legs, as it were, right? And you can imagine the irony of all that. And he says what? You intended it for evil, but God intended it for good. And so those are the things that happen in our lives as well. You know, we have that biblical example. Of course, we just went through the book of Job, and Job is perhaps a quintessential example of somebody who hadn't done anything wrong and yet was suffering tremendously. He didn't understand what was going on behind the scenes. He thought that, you know, why is this happening? I'm a righteous individual. Eventually, you can see him beginning to crack and beginning to say to himself and talk to his friends and say, why is this happening to me? I try to take care of the poor. I try to do things right. And yet, I'm undergoing these problems. Well, unbeknownst to Job, maybe he knows now, right? Maybe not. I don't know. But unbeknownst to him, the book of Job was being written from his experiences. And now, thousands of years later, we gain great comfort in knowing that a saint of God, one of the most righteous individuals that ever lived, as it's written there in the first chapter of Job, had to go through all of those problems, all of those difficulties. And he was not going through them for himself, but for those of us who will now read that book and be comforted by them. And so the moral of the story is that there's great comfort in helping one another. There's great comfort in knowing that we're going through difficulties, but at some point in the future, we're going to be able to use those experiences to help others who may be going through similar problems. An important aspect of what Paul is saying here is that we are to consider ourselves as we are correcting the misbehavior of our brother. When you go back to verse 1, Paul says again, we are to consider ourselves. He reminds us that we seek to correct another brother's fault, but we don't do it arrogantly. We do it humbly, understanding that we too can fall into sin. We have to have a reflection about those issues, about those things. We all don't have the same weaknesses. You know, individuals, for example, to use an example, may have problems with alcohol. I may not have that problem. That doesn't mean that I may not fall into another sin if I am not careful. That's why I have to make sure that I am sober and that I am vigilant all the time and that I am not just simply helping correct that behavior, but at the same time, I am having some problems or I end up falling into a similar sin myself because I am so focused on correcting the other individual that I forget that I too have weaknesses. There's always the temptation to set ourselves up as the moral teachers, right? The people, the go-to individual that people come to when problems arise on their sin in the church or things of that nature. And sort of like, you know, that can build some arrogance in us because we begin to look at ourselves as maybe more than we ought to. We are, after all, human, right? And that is a problem that we humans have. We point the sin in others, we point to the sin in others, but we have a terrible time realizing that we too have a lot of sin in our lives. We have a lot of problems in our lives. We have a lot of weaknesses in our lives. It's always very simple to look at another individual and say, that person has this problem. But when it comes to ourselves, we have a lot of trouble being self-reflective. So it is essential for us to understand that we need to think of ourselves humbly and understand our position is to help others, and to help others remembering that we too can fall into sin. Some folks within the church seem to think that they're the troubleshooters, right? And they think that any problem that comes up is for them to set right. And that's not the case. Look, and I'm not contradicting myself, right? I'm not going to tell you on the one hand, help people with their problems, and then on the other hand, I'm going to tell you, no, don't do that. But you have to understand that there is a time and a place for doing those things, right? If you don't know a person very well at all, a Christian within the church very well at all, well, then it's not likely they're going to receive you very well if you go to them and say, you know, you should do these things this way and that way and the other way, right? And so it goes back to building those relationships. So if you have a relationship with a particular individual, a trusting relationship with a particular individual, then go to that individual and say, you did something wrong, and here's how to set it right. Because ultimately, setting it right is the important thing, right? We often hear from the pulpit about Matthew 18 and the fact that we need to bring sin into the open and correct that sin. But what is the purpose of doing that? It isn't just so that the person will feel bad. It's so that the person will be restored, right? The very thing that Paul is talking about here is the idea that the person needs to be restored. The person needs to come back to the way of truth. We have to remember the words that Paul himself wrote in Romans 12 and 3. For through the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. And so he said this in the context of presenting ourselves as a living sacrifice to God. We should be careful that we don't become so proud because we consider ourselves highly spiritual. So on the one hand, realize that we have the Spirit. We're guided by the Spirit. And thus, in that context, in that respect, we are spiritual. On the other hand, we need to have humility. We need to realize that we are people, that we are humans, that we are subject to the same temptations and trials that our brothers and sisters are subjected to as well. And we are people who are not proud of our humility, right? We understand that we are human and we are fallible. We are weak as well. We have to have a sober balance in the way that we view ourselves. Paul wrote to the Corinthians, and this is essential for us to understand, in 2 Corinthians 13:5, test yourselves to see if you are in the faith. Examine yourselves. Or do you not recognize this about yourselves, that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you fail the test? And so it's in that self-reflection that we can avoid falling prey to the temptations that I've mentioned. But notice that we have to make that reflection according to what? The Word of God, right? We can't do it according to what other people think, not even what we have remembered reading somewhere. Those things are important. Those things are useful. But ultimately, it all comes back to the Word. The Word abiding within us. That is why it's so important to read the Word, to study the Word, to memorize the Word. All right? Because that is the tool that the Spirit will use to help us in that self-reflection. And to help us overcome that sin and that weakness in our lives. So it is essential for us to understand that we need to be in the Word all the time. Hearing it preach, studying it for ourselves, right? Not just preach. Because obviously nowadays there's a lot of access to preaching. All you have to do is turn on the internet and you'll have millions of preachers there talking about all kinds of things, right? But unfortunately, a lot of them are telling you things that are not true. And so the discernment to be able to know which ones are telling you the truth only comes through your own self-study of the Word of God, right? You have to bring that to bear. The Word, said the writer of Hebrews in Hebrews 4:12, of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, and piercing as far as the division of the soul and spirit, of both joints and marrow, and able to judge the thoughts and intentions of the heart. And so it is the Word that serves as our mirror, our infallible mirror. We are fallible people. We err. The Word does not. And therefore, it will always show us our true selves. Paul closes this section by telling the Galatians that each of us must bear our own load. And again, that's not a contradiction, right? In verse 2, he says, bear each other's loads. In verse 5, he says, everybody has to bear their own load. The difference is that in verse 2, as I mentioned, it's helping someone with a load that is too heavy for them to carry. In verse 5, now it's a totally different kind of load. This is the load that the Lord has given us to carry, right? The load that Jesus spoke about in Matthew chapter 11. You remember there that famous passage where he says, come unto me all who are heavy laden and are burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall have rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And so that is the burden that the Lord has laid upon us. There is a yoke that the Lord has laid upon each one of us. And that is a load and a yoke that none of us can give to one another. Yes, we can help each other with it. But it is our work that we must do. We must all do that work. The Lord has told us, you need to do these things. You need to help your brother. You need to help those who are in need. You need to evangelize, for example. And so all of that work that the Lord has given us to do is ours to do. And we cannot delegate it to anyone else. And so that's why Paul says here in verse 5 that we need to ensure that we are carrying our own loads and not letting others carry them for us. And again, go back to what I said earlier, right? How we all have this responsibility. Not just the leaders of the church, not just those that we consider the more mature or the more knowledgeable. Each of us has a work to do within the body. And again, we often use the example that Paul used in 1 Corinthians 12 about the body, right? And some parts of the body are, as he says, more honorable than others, right? Or they do more work than others. You know, your hands, you might think your hands more important than your hair, right? And, you know, for some people, maybe not, right? For those who don't have any hair might think, well, you know, I like to have more. But the reality is, what does the hair do compared to the hands, right? And if you had to say, I'd rather have hands or hair, which one would you pick, right? Your hands, obviously, right? And so, yes, that is the reality within the spiritual body as well. There are some folks who do more work than others, have more capacity than others. You know, they have been given more ability by the Lord to do that work. But even those parts that may not have as much capacity, as much ability, still have a function within the body, right? And so it's important for each of us to bear that in mind and to ensure that we are carrying that load ourselves. So let me finish by summarizing what Paul is laying out here. First, don't overlook sin. Make sure that you point out sin when necessary. It is up to the body as a whole to guard the purity of the body, making sure that we are not hypocritically demanding in others what we ourselves are not willing to give. And so don't let the fact that you don't want to be a hypocrite deter you from doing the hard work of correcting somebody. Ensure that you're not being a hypocrite. It's like I always say, the answer is not abstain from doing the right because you may think of yourself a hypocrite. The answer is do the right and don't be a hypocrite, right? It's a simple solution, simple formula. And so it's hard in practice, but it's simple on paper. But we must carry it out at all times. Second, don't just point out the sin. Make sure that you're helping the guilty individual overcome the sin and help them carry that load. A share load is a lighter load. And so we don't just correct somebody, we also teach somebody. A good parent, for example, is the one who is not just correcting the misbehavior of their children, but is also teaching them why what they did is wrong and how to do it right. That is a good parent. And if you're not doing those kinds of things in the body, well, then you're not doing what Paul is asking us to do here. Third, consider yourself. Make sure that you're not pointing out other people's sins while at the same time, like the Jews Paul speaks of in Romans 2, engaging in those same sins yourself, right? It is, and again, I use the example. A lot of folks, unfortunately, who are famous preachers have been caught in sins. And your first thought is, you know, being in the pulpit talking against all these things when they themselves in secret were carrying on these things. And so you can see there a great glaring example of how not to do it. Right? Make sure that you are not engaging in the things that you are seeking to correct in others. And if you have a weakness in that area, well, then seek out someone who can help you with it. And then fourthly, and finally, don't neglect to do the work God has given you to do. Don't be so focused on what everyone else is doing that you fail in the task that God has appointed you to do. And don't compare yourself with other people. It is essential for you to compare yourself to the Word and to carry your load and to do your work. Right? Someone else is going to do their own work. You have to your own work to do, which the Lord has given you to do. Don't be so focused and worried about what other people are doing that you yourself fall by the wayside. That's what kids do, right? Children who are immature. They're saying, but he did it, or he's not doing it, right? And so the idea is, well, we feel vindicated because, you know, our friend over there down the street is doing or not doing whatever the case may be, right? That's not how we mature Christians should behave. We should realize that we ourselves stand before our Lord ourselves. You know, no one else can stand for us. We cannot stand for anyone else. And so we ourselves have to do the work the Lord has given us to do. Let's close in prayer.